From the WEMU newsroom, I'm Amanda LeClaire. Attorney Barbara Arnwine has been a significant force for social change during her long career. She led the Lawyers Committee, a civil rights organization created at the behest of President John F. Kennedy, for 26 years. Arnwine is the 2016 keynote speaker at Eastern Michigan University's Martin Luther King Jr. Day celebrations. She joins me now.
You know, you've been a very prominent civil rights attorney over the course of your career, and you did just leave your position as executive director of the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law. And I was wondering how you look back, personally, look back upon your career, and which successes stand out for you the most.
Well, you know, I remember being a young girl at 12 years old and seeing the March on Washington on television. And being moved beyond words. In fact, I was captivated. I was fixated because I saw these people coming together of all these different races, demanding change and seeking justice. And I think that moment sunk deep in my heart and that it guided me the rest of my life. And my career in civil rights and social justice causes has been guided by a desire to make this country the best it can be, so much better than it can be, and to make it just and racially just and economically just and genderly equal. These have been the passions of my life. And so when I look back on my 26 years at the Lawyers Committee, I'm grateful. Because, you know, everybody's desire is to be able to work at the things that your heart loves and that your heart desires. And I've been blessed to do this work. It hasn't been easy. It's, you know, it's very frustrating sometimes. It's absolutely terrifying to see the injustices that are out here in our society. But to be able to do something about it, to win victories for people, to change laws, to, you know, fight for, you know, better governments, to do the things that we've done has been a blessing.
You've done a lot of work on voting rights and voter suppression. Can you talk about how you see the landscape of that, given that this is an election year that we're coming up into?
Oh, I think it is the most important American challenge, that having a robust and open, unfettered and non-discriminatory electoral process is absolutely key to a good democracy. You can't have a democracy where you are purposefully excluding huge segments of the population from voting. The fight against voter suppression has been, you know, the war of my lifetime. When I started talking publicly about voter suppression back in 2000, people thought, you know, I had a horned head. They thought I had grown, you know, horns out of my head and that I was just talking a conspiracy theory. But I saw then, for the first time in 2000, deceptive practices where people were, you know, trying to cheat people out of voting by telling them that they could not vote. I saw for the first time, you know, racial discrimination blatantly, where people were using, systematic practices to exclude blacks from voting, especially, you know, in Florida, where we had to sue the state in the NAACP versus a Harris case that we eventually won. Through a consent decree. But, you know, when we tried to tell people about that, all people wanted to talk about were hanging chads and Palm Beach, and we couldn't get people to think and look at the racial dimensions. In 2004, I had the same fight. And this time it was worse because I saw that the voter suppression, at least in the deceptive practices and other kinds of deliberate exclusionary schemes against Latinos, Native Americans, and African Americans had gotten worse. But the press, you know, just didn't want to talk about it. it took us until 2011, after the midterm election of 2010, and you got these several chambers of state legislatures changed their hands and became predominantly, you know, one party. And all of a sudden, within 2 months of taking office, we saw 40 states move simultaneously to exclude people's ability to vote by adopting everything from voter ID laws to restricting early voting to getting rid of their same-day election registration laws to making it harder for young people to register and vote. We saw, you know, all kinds of, you know, increased deceptive practices where people were being told that they could, you know, vote by phone, all the rest of it. But it was the state legislative efforts that really gave us the ability to point to actual legislation, and for the first time, the press got it. That's why my son and I created the Map of Shame. We got out there and we were able to show the public and show the press and show the punditry what was going on with voter suppression. And when people saw it, they got it for the first time. And so sometimes, you know, it is like howling, you know, against the wind when you're out with a cause that people don't see, don't understand, and don't appreciate. But the lesson of my life is that you got to press on, that your mistake is when you abandon your cause because you think people will never get it. Instead, you got to find the best ways and get creative and innovative and really, you know, fight hard for people to see the injustice and make it tangible for them to understand what it looks like, how it operates, and the effect it has on all of us. Because every single American has an interest in having a good democracy where people want to vote and where people are allowed to vote if they are eligible to vote.
You mentioned the changes to early voting and changes to absentee ballots and those sort of things.
Yes.
On its face, that doesn't sound like it's voter suppression of any sort. How can you explain the ways that those?
What we were able to do was explain to people that in North Carolina, Florida, most states, Ohio, African Americans vote early at 3 to 4 to 5 times the rate of white Americans. And that's because we don't have the flexibility with our jobs. We don't have the flexibility, you know, with our lifestyles. You know, when somebody can get a ride, they need to get a ride because a lot of people don't have cars. And people don't understand how critical early voting is to African Americans and very important to Latinos who also tend to vote early. So in Florida, African Americans voted early over, you know, 60% of all African American voters voted early. In Florida, 40% of all Latino voters voted early. So when you start all of a sudden saying, oh, well, we don't want early voting, which is so effective that allowed millions upon millions of Americans to vote, then you are, in fact, limiting the franchise. And why are you doing this suddenly when it was, you know, being effective and when people were using it so well? Why all of a sudden are you making arguments for cutting back? And so we put the question to people about how is this logical and how does this support a democracy where we say that, you know, people don't care because we only have a 60% turnout, and we consider that good. But in states where we have, you know, good early voting, where we have, you know, same-day registration during voting, people's turnout rates are as high as 70%. So if we really want to be a democracy that is inclusive of all people, then taking down the barriers is the answer, not erecting them.
There's been a lot of, on college campuses especially, a lot of growing movements in Black student unions and the Black Lives Matter movements. What kind of advice do you have for some of those young activists?
Well, you know, you're going to lose some. Absolutely. You're not going to always win. But if you unite, the odds of winning against an institution are slim. But if you can inspire and unite people to see the commonality of our, you know, quest as humanity for dignity, when you do that kind of fight, then you can change things.
And now you're going to be here on Monday to be the keynote speaker at Eastern Michigan University's Martin Luther King Jr. Day luncheon. Where do you see that we as a country have helped fulfill his dream, and where have we failed?
Well, we failed by abandoning the urgency of now. That was one of his favorite expressions. Now is the time, he hollered at the end of the Selma march, as he stood there and gave his speech on the steps of the Capitol of Alabama that had been so defiant. He spoke about the urgency of now. Now is the time. And we have lost that sense of urgency about racial progress. We become too complacent with inequality. We become too complacent, and we've convinced ourselves that we can't make progress. We convinced ourselves that it's all their fault. Whoever is suffering. We convinced ourselves of these really untruths. And what is important is for us to regain that sense of urgency. Right now on the internet, there's a story about Apple, a computer company, Apple, saying basically that it would be too burdensome for them to do more to promote diversity. That kind of attitude is our problem. That's our real burden. That's our real problem. It's when we believe that we have no urgency, no desire, no will to fight for change. And we cannot look at a country that is going to be predominantly people of color and not be talking about real equality. That is dooming our country to ineffectiveness and all kinds of, you know, rifts and all kinds of problems. What we need in leadership is not demonization of one race versus another. What we need in leadership is not fear-mongering. What we need in leadership is competency in cultural change, and believing that we can become a society that is diverse, that is equitable, that is economically open, that is just to all people. And until we do that, we have not embraced King's dream. We have not done his legacy justice. We are not living up to the creed of the dream.
Barbara Arnwine is a prominent civil rights attorney and former executive director of the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights. She's also the host of Igniting Change with Barbara Arnwine on Radio 1's WOLU 1450. She'll be the keynote speaker at Eastern Michigan University's 2016 Martin Luther King Jr. Day celebration. For 89.1 WEMU, I'm Amanda LeClaire.